We have fed you all for a thousand years, and you hail us still unfed. Though there's never a dollar of all your wealth but marks the workers dead, we have yielded our best to give you rest, and you lie on crimson wool. Then if blood be the price of all your wealth, good God, we have paid in full. We have fed you all for a thousand years, for that was our doom, you know. From the days when you chained us in your fields to the strike of a week ago, you have taken our lives and our husbands and wives, and we're told it's your illegal share. But if blood be the price of your lawful wealth, good God, we have bought it fair.
And that was We Have Fed You All for a Thousand Years from the Little Red Songbook of the IWW. Starting off our WOB radio show today, we're going to go ahead and kick it off with fellow worker Lynn with introductions to all of our fellow members here assembled. Go ahead and take it away.
Well, thank you, Noah. To my left, we have Gordon. Please introduce yourself, Gordon.
Hello, listeners. My name is fellow worker Gordon. I've been a member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World since 2008, on and off. And I live in Bremerton, but I'm a member of this branch, proudly so.
And my name is fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns. I've been a part of the Tacoma IWW since March of 2021. I also contribute to the Seattle Worker as a writer and an editor. I contribute to the Industrial Worker from time to time, writing articles for them as well. And I'm also one of the production members of the Industrial... I'm also one of the production members for WOB Radio.
And I am fellow worker Marilyn, and I use she, they. I've been a member since about 2008. I'm a delegate, so if you want to join up, you need to contact a delegate, and we can help you do that. And I see my role as connecting. So I belong to a lot of groups, and I connect them to each other because I know very well that one person's injury is an injury to all. That's what I do.
I'm fellow worker Lynn, and I've been a member since approximately 2007, and like Gordon, on and off. There were reasons why I was off, but anyway, never off anymore. I'm on with IWW. I'm the treasurer of the IWW. In case you haven't been listening before, WOB radio means...
It means wobbly radio. Yeah. And wobbly is a term that we fellow union members use in reference to each other because one of the things we're known for is wobbling on the job, which means organizing for better pay, hours, conditions, things like that, to struggle, essentially. Fellow worker Marilyn, we're going to read a section to the preamble of the Constitution.
So this is a section from our IWW preamble, and you're welcome to look up and find the whole preamble. It's only one page, but this is the section I'll share today. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against the other set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. So that's why when you, listener, when you hear the word IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, we are talking about industrial unionism versus trade unionism. Industrial unionism organizes an entire industry from top to bottom. And that's the big difference with trade union.
All righty. So our first bit of labor news today that we'd like to report on here at WOB Radio, and this is coming out locally from Tacoma, there was a rally on October 3rd to support Tacoma City workers. And we're reporting on an article from The Stand, which is a website which reports news about working people standing together in Washington State and is one of our primary labor-related news sources from this region. Yes?
I just want to interject that The Stand is a publication online of the Washington State Labor Council of the AFL-CIO.
Thank you. So this is coming out of Tacoma. Members of Teamsters 117 and IBEW 483 have been in negotiations with the city of Tacoma for nearly a year. The city continues to make anemic wage proposals that are significantly below inflation and significantly below what the city has offered other unionized employees with the city. The Teamsters IBEW members and their labor and community partners held a rally on October 3rd in front of the city hall to demand fair contract for city workers. Workers at the city of Tacoma provide essential services to its residents. They repair the city's roads, clean up its parks, keep its streets safe, and operate its libraries, but the city continues to shut them down with no respect for their labor. In mediation, the union provided the city with a detailed breakdown of class and compensation work to justify demands for higher wages, but the city has failed to respond to the workers' proposal. So this was an article rallying support for that. I was not personally able to attend that rally at the time, but there was actually a pretty good turnout. I think there was a few hundred people outside of City Hall. So this is something that, as far as I've been able to find from my own research, is something that's still ongoing. The city has not reached any kind of tentative agreement with Teamsters 117 or IBEW 483. And this is a pretty big issue to me personally, because one of my first jobs out of college was actually with Teamsters 117. I used to do street operations with the city of Tacoma for a seasonal position for about 10 or 11 months at the time. And I really did appreciate the support that the union gave. And it was my first opportunity to participate in unionism as a whole. So I really hope that the workers of 117 and IBEW branch as well get what they deserve.
There's no law that says that if you're union, that the other side must bargain?
Oh, no, there is. Once unions and their employers reach a tentative agreement with each other, they have to bargain in good faith, is how the law is written. Yes, fellow worker?
That's commonly known as a recognition effort or a recognition strike, which means that you're trying to get your outfit, your group of fellow workers
recognized
as a legitimate union. And that's a big step, because if you don't get that step, then the employer, whether government or private, has no obligation to sit down and negotiate with you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, who determines that?
The National Labor Relations Board.
The NLRB, yes. They do a lot of the labor law related enforcement, pretty much all the labor law related enforcement in the United States. And so they have a specific process for how those negotiations are supposed to operate. Basically, what's happening right now, from what it sounds like here in the city of Tacoma, is that they're still currently re-upping their contract negotiations, but the city keeps giving anemic wage increases, and the workers are demanding better because it's not keeping up with inflation. And we've reported it on WAB Radio in the past that things like the cost of housing, the cost of groceries, just overall the cost of living in the city has gone up significantly within the past 5 years. Mm-hmm. Rent itself has gone up probably 30-40% in most neighborhoods.
Well, there have been some disappointing bits of news about the NLRB in the last few months, where they've not really supported unions. They've been the opposite, so they're like getting watered down, and I hope that's not a trend.
Can you think of anything in particular, specific?
No, I just remember it from a previous radio show that we were talking about, that it was not a good decision for labor.
Yeah, the NLRB kind of has its own issues when it comes to mediating negotiations between unions and their employers. I think probably one of the biggest flaws of it, and I'd love to discuss this in a later episode because I know we have a different roundtable conversation for today for our listeners, but there are a lot of positions in the NLRB which are determined. Yes, they're political positions. So every new presidential administration, even within the same presidential administration, you can have a shakeup of the executives who actually run the NLRB, depending on whether or not the president or the party in power is pro-labor or anti-labor.
Or they can even hold up the filling of a position in the NLRB if they're so inclined to interfere with labor advancements.
Absolutely. I'm going to go ahead and move on to our next labor news article that we have. And this is coming out of the Northwest Labor Press. This is based out of Southern Washington, Northern Oregon area, but they cover a pretty wide swath of Washington and Oregon when it comes to labor-related news articles, and is another one of our primary resources for labor-related news. This one was posted October 19th. the biggest healthcare strike in U.S. history. Some of you might have seen this in the headlines. A coalition of unions representing workers at Kaiser Permanente facilities in 8 states reached a tentative agreement with Kaiser executives October 13th, less than a week after an estimated 75,000 workers struck for 3 days, the largest U.S. healthcare strike on record. The agreement addresses many of the wage and staffing issues the coalition of Kaiser Permanente unions said drove the strike, but at least one union in the coalition is planning another walkout in Washington on November 1st if local negotiations with Kaiser remain locked up. The coalition of Kaiser Permanente unions is made up of 11 local unions that bargain together across from Kaiser over a national contract that covers more than 85,000 Kaiser employees in 7 states: Washington, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Maryland, Virginia, plus Washington, D.C. coalition members. Locally based unions include the SEIU Local 49 and Washington-based SEIU Local 1199 Northwest and the Office of Professional Employees International Union Local 8. So they struck from October 4th through 6th.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's my understanding now that they were not striking in Tacoma. Is that correct?
From what I've been able to find, they were not striking.
Because I went down there looking for them to go support them in their strike, and there was nobody there.
Yes, fellow worker?
It was mostly focused, the strike action was mostly focused in the Vancouver area of Washington State and in the Portland area of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And they specifically mentioned that so that you could honor those locals that were going out on strike without hindering the locals that had not opted for that yet. But the whole idea, because I'm a Kaiser Permanente victim,
mm-hmm.
and so I was wondering about that because I had a checkup coming up. And if I would have seen any pickets, I would have joined the picket line.
Right.
But they specifically tried to make that easier because they know it's very inconvenient for seniors and for youth, you know, to get in to see the doctor when they need to if there's a strike going on.
Yeah.
So they were very targeted about that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult for healthcare workers to strike, especially because of concerns like that. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, I don't not want healthcare workers to strike. But on the other hand, there still has to be a minimum amount of staff that have to remain on the job. Because like you said, mm-hmm. people still need healthcare at the end of the day. And there still needs to be somebody manning the computer or manning the exam room in order to make sure that happens.
You know, I wondered a lot because I believe it was last week, and they were still striking, correct, last week?
They only struck for 3 days, according to...
It was a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, according to Northwest Labor Press, they struck from October 4th through the 6th, so it was only a 3-day strike.
Okay.
I believe that there were a couple other locals that struck for slightly longer because their specific contracts in that area were taking a little bit longer to negotiate, so the strike kind of extended. But the gross majority of the workers struck between October 4th through 6th.
Okay.
They were protesting bad faith bargaining by Kaiser. The walkout did not include members of the coalition unions in Maryland, Hawaii, and Northwestern Washington, which is why we didn't see any picket lines around here. The local contract that covers SEIU 1199 in Washington included a no-strike clause and does not expire until October 31st.
Wow.
The tentative agreement, brokered with the help of...
Hang on just a minute. I do not agree with no strike clauses. I just want to make a point of that.
Yeah, I'm...
It chops people off at the knees.
That's an issue within the industrial workers of the world right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Should we honor no strike clauses? And the general consensus I've seen on the Wobbly forums is no, we should never have no strike. If we bargain for a contract, we should never have no strike clauses in the contract.
Could that hinder employment?
Potentially, if workers were to break contract by violating a no strike clause, then the employer can retaliate against employees mm-hmm. that are breaking the no strike
yeah.
clause.
But see, people should never sign it to begin with. Now,
that's
if you're going to,
if you're going to be hired on, do you have to sign something like that to be hired on?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're getting hired on in an organized workplace and there's no right to work concessions, like you don't have to be a member of the union, for example, then if you were to sign that no-strike clause with the union, with your employer, and then later violate it, you could lose your employment. Yes, absolutely.
But what I wanted to point out is if we as IWW members want to support SEIU or some other organization that's a trade union that has signed one of those no-strike clauses, mm-hmm. we need to be really careful that we don't jeopardize them against their wishes. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's something that if we really want to be supported, we have to find another way.
Well, that kind of goes without saying in our union that, you know, we're into labor solidarity, and we will support any outfit that's going out on strike or taking other action. And generally, the IWW is courteous and asks. So we have a bunch of wobblies here who want to show up at your picket, you know, mm-hmm. and occasionally we're not welcome, but most of the time we are of course welcome because they appreciate labor solidarity.
Absolutely. So just to close out this news article right here, the SEIU Local 49 represents about 4,000 Kaiser workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Patients have reported long wait times to schedule appointments or checked in when they arrive for care. Local 49 member Kevin Darden serves on the local bargaining committee and works at the patient registration desk at Kaiser Sunnyside. His job is to check patients in for their appointments and surgeries. He said in early 2020, his team had 60 workers, enough to fully staff all 5 check-in windows. Now the team only has 37, and as many as 3 windows stay closed for the day. So a lot of the issues that they were striking for were not just wage increases because of the increased cost of living.
Staffing.
But staffing especially, which has been mm-hmm. a long, notorious issue in the healthcare system.
And the population's growing in Washington.
Well, yeah. And if you have an adequate staff, then the other thing that ends up going is your break times.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality of service to the customer.
Sure.
And one thing about healthcare workers and arguably food service workers is that they care about the customer too, because they need to go to the doctor and they need to go get a hamburger. And so they understand, you know, the struggles that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the time, if you say, you know, we want better staffing or safe staffing, is how I've heard it put here in Washington, then the public will be on your side. It might be inconvenient, but if people know the issues, they will generally be on the side of the workers.
Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
I don't remember the branch, but I'm sure we've all heard about in the military that one senator, Tuberville, is holding up the promotions. And so one high up was doing the job of 2 people, and apparently the jobs are pretty intricate.
Mm-hmm.
And we're at a time of potential war, and we're by proxy at war. And so that guy, once he was actually doing, and that's how stress can affect us. And they really credit it, they attribute it to his workload, and that can happen to human beings.
Absolutely.
And Tommy Tuberville should be ashamed.
He's incapable of it, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the commandant of the United States Marine Corps.
Okay.
They haven't had a commandant. So the second, you know, the deputy commandant, which is, you know, not like saying vice president. I mean, these guys in the military have definite areas of responsibility. And so this guy was actually taken on 2 jobs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so the stress gave him a heart attack. Now, who's the deputy commandant of the Marine Corps,
God,
right?
Really? Yeah, it's dangerous. Yeah, I never thought I'd be, like, loudly supporting the military. But certain things, you know, morality.
Moving on to our next labor story here, and this is another local article coming out of Tacoma, Washington. This is also, again, from thestand.org. The ILWU 22 members picket for a fair contract at the Port of Tacoma, and this was from October 18th. Hardworking members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the ILWU, Local 22, held an informational picket outside the Port of Tacoma offices on Tuesday morning, immediately prior to the regularly scheduled commissioner meeting. More than 40 members lined the entrance with signs demanding a fair contract and a cost of living adjustment that keeps up with inflation. One young supporter carried a sign that said, "Diapers are expensive, pay my dad cola." Trucks and other cars passing by honked their horns in approval of the action. Quote, "We are part of the union team that kept this port going through COVID," said Local 22 President Mike Kiask. "While management continues to do remote work, we do what we've done every day, show up and keep the port moving. We are dedicated to our work and deserve a contract that keeps up with the cost of living, unquote. When the commissioners heard of the informational picket, they canceled their regular meeting and urged both sides to meet and work out a solution. Quote, in more than 50 years of my work, I have never crossed a picket line and I was not going to do so today, said retired ILWU member and current Port of Tacoma commissioner Dick Marzano.
Good.
Bargaining sessions resume on October 18th when this article was posted. I have not seen any follow-up to this action, not from the union, but in terms of contract negotiations. By the sounds of it, they're probably still in negotiations since it's only been a couple of weeks. This is another local action by the ILWU here in Tacoma. The International Longshore Union especially has been known for its great union solidarity and I would even go so far as to say great militarism when it comes to being able to walk out on strike and get as much support as possible. Militancy, I should say.
They call it a militant union.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Militant unionism.
This story ties into another one of our labor stories that we wanted to report on today, which is also coming out of the Northwest, but unfortunately has a sad tone. This is another ILWU article out of Northwest Labor Press. The ILWU is declaring bankruptcy. This was posted a day after the previous article mentioned. International Longshore and Warehouse Union, which represents 32,260 workers on Pacific Coast Docks warehouses and at Powell's Books in Portland, filed September 30th for a Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Chapter 11 isn't the kind of bankruptcy where an organization liquidates its assets and goes out of business. It's a procedure for asking the court to relieve its debt. The ILWU is seeking bankruptcy protection because it's unable to pay $19 million in court-awarded damages to ICTSI, the Philippine Stevedoring Company that operated Portland's Terminal 6 from 2010 to 2017. The ICTSI was part of the the Pacific Maritime Association, and ILWU's agreement with PMA gave it jurisdiction over most jobs on the docks, including the work of plugging in refrigerated shipping containers when they were unloaded from ships. At Terminal 6, that work had historically been done by union members Local 48 because they worked for the Port of Portland, and the port ran publicly owned Terminal 6 directly until 2010. When ICTSI refused to give work to the ILWU, the union went to war. According to the National Labor Relations Board, the ILWU members engaged in a sustained slowdown in 2012. The ICTSI sued the ILWU in federal court to recoup its losses, and a jury awarded $93.5 million in damages in 2019, an award later reduced by a judge to only $19 million. The ICTSI didn't accept that reduction and went back to court, with a court date set for February of 2024. In its bankruptcy filing, the ILWU proposes to turn over virtually its entire bank account to ICTSI, $9.5 million, but then return to normal operations. Quote, while we have attempted numerous times to resolve the decade-long litigation with ICTSI Oregon Incorporated, at this point the union can no longer afford to defend against ICTSI's scorched earth litigation tactic, the ILWU President Willie Adams said in an October 1st press statement. So the ILWU is kind of in a really bad situation right now.
Is this a direct result of a Supreme Court ruling that said that if you strike, that the company can sue you for loss of income?
Well, this slowdown took place in 2012. So mm-hmm. that was years before that decision okay. was made. However, I would personally be willing to speculate that the ICTSI would be willing to use that in order to get more damages out of the ILWU.
Just a terrible decision anyway, and that stemmed from our concrete worker, Teamster
right.
brothers and sisters up in Seattle, who went on a strike against a couple of concrete companies and allegedly walked off the job with concrete still in the trucks,
oh, yeah.
which set up, of course, mm-hmm. and which cost the company a lot of money to repair. We had a segment on a previous radio show,
right.
maybe three or four radio shows ago, where we talked about this a little, how it was a limited impact. That's what they were saying. It's a limited impact because the court decided against the union. Okay, and I, at the time, said, no, this is going to open a floodgate. because it's precedence, legal precedent. So that means if I use the only tactic that labor has in order to get justice, which is withdrawal of our labor,
yeah,
right, that I could be sued for possible potential loss of profits to the corporation. And I saw that as opening the door to a disaster.
Right.
Was that part of, was it Citizens United?
No.
And they gave corporations the power to...
No.
No, this was a separate decision by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, Citizens United was about political contributions. And that's the one where they came up with the aphorism that money is speech.
And corporations are people.
Yeah. That was Mitt Romney's big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so different court decision, but yeah, in line with anti-labor and anti-worker decisions of late.
Yeah, this ILWU situation is especially concerning because, like I mentioned a couple minutes ago, the ILWU has done fantastic organizing work and has a great amount of solidarity with its workers. They've pulled off strikes and slowdowns and other retaliations against their employers' unjust treatment in the past. And the fact that such a giant of organized labor is currently facing this situation really does not encourage.
So what can the listener do to support this union? Is there a place where they can donate?
I mean, it would be hard-pressed to find $19 million, to be
honest. Well, you
know
what? If enough people give $10, you know, I mean, this could add some solidarity for them.
I would recommend that if a listener is concerned, that they contact the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union. The Tacoma local is 22. I believe the Longview local is 21. Anyway, they have different jurisdictions. And they probably have Facebook pages or their own website and frequently asked questions. And so you can get on and look them up and actually inquire, what can I do to help you guys?
Good point.
And if they do have a strike or if they do have an informational picket, that's another thing that the individual citizen can go do. Say, I am here in support of your union. I'll walk your picket line with you.
But as for the future, I'm not sure if there are any GoFundMe or crowdsourcing funding currently going on from friends of the union in order to help pay off these debts.
Yeah.
As for the time being, it sounds like they're going to be going back to court in February of 2024 in order to rehash how much the union is going to owe the company. But the point still remains, the union only has about $9.5 million in its bank account, which is quite a bit for a union, to be quite frank. But at the same time, even a $19 million reduced fine against the union would put them into bankruptcy. And they are filing bankruptcy right now, at the very least Chapter 11 bankruptcy. So I think that this is something that our fellow listeners and other friends of unionists need to keep a close eye on, because in reference to the Supreme Court decision that we mentioned, which allows employers to sue unions for going on strike or slowing down and impacting company profits, I think that that ruling might potentially affect the ruling that could come down in this situation as well.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly give all of our solidarity to the ILWU and the work that they've done.
Hell yeah.
If I could finish off our news segment here with one last article. This is coming out of thestand.org. This article was published October 27th. Tell Windmill Farms financier Instar to do the right thing. This is coming out of Sunnyside, Washington. More than a year after they voted to join together in a union with the United Farm Workers, the mushroom workers at Ostrom/Windmill Farms continue to demand recognition of their union and negotiation for a fair contract. But management continues to ignore the workers. So for now, the UFW is stepping up its pressure on the Canadian Investment Corporation that financed the Windmill Farms purchase of Ostrom Farms earlier this year. Instar Asset Management would be using its influence to make sure this labor dispute is resolved and workers' right to form a union together is respected. The UFW writes, because of Ostrom's outrageous labor practices, workers voted in 2022 to unionize with the UFW. They are demanding a halt to gender discrimination, currently under investigation by the Washington State Attorney General, threats, retaliation, and workplace injuries, as well as asking for fair wages and safe working conditions. Once this purchase went through with Instar's funding, workers were called into meetings, informed the company had sold, and told everyone was fired. The workers were offered jobs at the new company, Windmill Farms, but they would earn less, have a 90-day 90-day probationary period when they could be fired for any reason, and they would only be hired back if they signed an arbitration agreement, mm-hmm. giving up their rights to sue the company if it violates the law. Workers shared they had to sign on the spot or leave. Even official papers said they had 24 hours. Many had to accept jobs they had no training for, including people with on-the-job injuries that required light duty. Mushroom workers are keeping up their fight at Windmill Farms, where the union says the same unethical behavior continues. More than 100 workers and supporters recently rallied in front of the plant to give the company a strong message that they are not backing down. So, we have previously talked on WOB Radio about farm workers' conditions up in the Skagit County area. We know that the Whatcom Skagit branch of the IWW has close relations with the farm workers' union up there as well. Gordon, do you remember the name of that union by chance?
Familias Unidas para Justicia.
Yes. We've done an interview previously with them here on WOB Radio. A lot of the farm workers up there have been struggling a lot with things like harassment from immigration control, poor working conditions, mistreatment by their employers, misinformation from their employers, and sometimes their employers straight up violating labor laws like this article insinuates.
Just to note, they are not affiliated with the UFW. They're an independent farm workers union. As a matter of fact, they had to struggle to form this union because the UFW didn't think they were big enough to represent. So they went out with a little bit of IWW assistance. Shout out to Whatcom Skagit IWW, and managed to form their own union and win their own contract.
Absolutely. As for these agricultural workers in northern Washington, I've already read off all of the issues that they deal with, but right now they are still struggling to really gain union power in that region of the state. A lot of these workers, as I've previously mentioned, are immigrant farm workers from Central and South America, many of whom are trying to support their families back where they immigrated from, or continuing to grow their families and financially support them here now that they've gained either a green card or a full citizenship. We certainly send our solidarity out to those farm workers. We do have a good relationship between the IWW and Familias Unidas. So we will be keeping updates on this as more news continues to come out.
Well, shout out to another outfit up in Bellingham, which is sort of a civilian outfit that supports the farm workers, and they're called Community to Community, or C2C. And they do a lot of good work supporting the farm workers up there directly.
And now to jump to international news, as well as our current roundtable discussion, we want to talk a little bit about the labor perspectives on the ongoing situation between Israel and the Gaza Strip. I want to start this out with some good news, however, because there has been a lot of grim reporting on the situation. This is coming out of labornotes.org. While many union members and other workers are worried and horrified at the mounting war in Israel and occupied Palestine, U.S. unions have so far remained mostly silent. But workers are speaking up and organizing with their coworkers to push their unions on the side of peace and justice. United Food and Commercial Workers, UFCW, Local 3000, and United Electrical Workers, UE, have sponsored a petition calling for a ceasefire. Starbucks Workers United has also spoken up. Quote, union members come from diverse backgrounds, including Jews, Muslims, and Middle Eastern communities, says the petition. The rising escalation of war and arms sales doesn't serve the interests of workers anywhere, unquote. Since Hamas killed 1,300 Israelis on October 7th, Israel has completely cut off electricity, food, and water to the Gaza Strip, forcibly displacing 1.1 million Palestinians, and is conducting airstrikes that have already killed approximately 3,500 Palestinians.
No, 8,000 now.
8,000?
Yeah.
This article was posted on October 19th.
I think the top nine, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
9,000 lives.
Human rights groups warn that Israel's actions violate international law and that we could be witnessing the beginning of a genocide. Even before the attacks and the war, UE at its September convention had passed a resolution demanding that the U.S. government end all military aid to Israel for its apartheid rule over Palestinians. That has included the confiscation of Palestinian homes and land by the right-wing government to expand Israeli settlements, cutting farmers off from their fields and water supplies, and treating Gaza as the world's largest open-air prison, with its residents trapped in abysmal economic and social conditions. So a lot of labor unions internationally are beginning to rally together behind Palestinians and the Palestinian workers that are trapped in the Gaza Strip. Here's another article, actually, really quickly, from the International Action Center, which provides information, activism, and resistance to U.S. militarism, war, and corporate greed, linking with struggles against racism and oppression within the United States. This is an article about the Palestine General Confederation of Trade Unions, an urgent call coming from them to end complicity and stop arming Israel.
And what was that group again?
The Palestine General Confederation of Trade Unions has recently called out for international labor unions to support the end of military arms shipments to Israel. Yes,
it's interesting that only one of the unions that you mentioned is an AFL-CIO affiliate.
I believe UE was the independent union, right?
UE is the independent union, and Starbucks Workers is independent. They're not affiliated with the
AFL-CIO. No, Starbucks Workers is affiliated with the AFL-CIO.
Did they?
Yes, they're with the SEIU.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Oh, well, that's too bad. But I haven't heard the AFL-CIO come out with a statement about...
I think because a lot of union workers are organized in industries which do provide sometimes arms or military supply for Israel. Mm-hmm. So they have to make negotiations on that basis as well. But by the sounds of it, it sounds like a lot of workers' unions, both here in the United States, as well as in England, Ireland, France, especially mm-hmm. with the CGT,
yep.
Trade unions in Germany as well, although they have to be very careful about how they phrase their language.
Very careful in Germany.
To give you a quote from the Palestine General Confederation of Trade Unions, their current demands are to refuse to build weapons destined for Israel, to refuse to transport weapons to Israel, to pass motions in their trade unions to this effect, to take action against complicit companies involved in implementing Israel's brutal and illegal siege, especially if they have contracts with your institution, and finally, pressure governments to stop all military trade with Israel and, in the case of the U.S., stop funding it.
Yes, please.
So that is the demand by the coalition of Palestinian trade unions, essentially. Right.
And they're not alone.
Mm-hmm. Just recently, Israel, actually, I believe this past week, basically rounded up all the Palestinian workers currently operating within their territories and forcibly deported them back to the Gaza Strip. And the unions in Palestine really raised the call about that as well.
Well, I have a lot of things to say about this personally. Can I just kind of launch on a rant, I guess?
Go ahead.
The listener may or may not know that I am Jewish, and I am also a member of the IWW, also a member of Veterans for Peace and Jewish Voice for Peace, which has been very active lately.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of feelings about what's going on, as Gordon can fill you in amply about the history that's led up to this horror. This has been building for a long time, ever since the partition into Palestine and Israel. And whereas I am keenly aware of the Ashkenazi Jewish population's history of having genocide from the Germans
mm-hmm.
and wanting to emigrate to a place that was safer, and being ceded the state of Israel by England in the Balfour Declaration. This has been ongoing for a long time. Prior to that, Jews and Arabs lived peaceably in the land of Palestine. But the tensions escalated after that determination in the Balfour Declaration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, initially, when that happened, most of the Muslim nations in the Middle East were very outraged at Palestinians' loss of land. And one thing that happened, it's called the Nakba. A lot of the Palestinians fled when Israel was declared a state. And they fled out of Palestine, and they have been in exile ever since. The Israeli state, the state of Israel, is not the same thing as the Jewish population.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make that clear. Hamas is not the same as the Palestinians. Go ahead.
Just to clarify for people who don't know, when we talk about Jewish people, and my father was Jewish, so I can speak a little bit. When we speak about Jewish people, there are branches of the Jewish people. And when we say Ashkenazi, that refers to principally European Jews who look like white people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that was from the Pale of Settlement in Russia and from Eastern Europe.
Not all of them,
but there's some from Turkey also.
Well, the ones from Turkey are Mizrahi.
Are they?
Yeah.
And Iran as well, yeah.
So
yeah.
There's Ashkenazi, Mizrahi,
Sephardi.
And Sephardic.
Right. So what I'm saying is that Jewish people are racially diverse. There are black Jews, Ethiopian Jews, Nubian mm-hmm. Jews, right? Right.
But I want to get back to the point here.
Sure thing. But I was just trying to illustrate to the listening public that it's not monolithic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the Nakba it's like when Jews refer to the Holocaust, the Nakba is the way that Palestinians refer to what happened to them after the partition of Palestine into Israel and Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And thousands and thousands of people fled, never to be able to return. The policy of Israel since the beginning has been a policy of increasing encroachment on lands that were designated by the Balfour Declaration as Palestinian lands.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in Gaza and
West Bank.
And the West Bank. Thank you, Gordon. So they built the wall, just like certain unmentionable person in the United States built the wall. To quote Make Us Safer, there is a good song about that, but I can't sing it to you. They have specifically conducted raids against people in Palestine and bombings and arrests. They have denied them the ability for health care when they needed it to cross the border. They have been responsible for the plowing up 1,000-year-old olive trees. They have done so much to make the lives of Palestinians in the West Bank untenable. And it's been referred to as an open-air ghetto. There is such a thing as Stockholm syndrome. There is such a thing as generational Stockholms. But there is also such a thing as deliberately keeping real history out of the history books for generations of young Israelis growing up so that they can learn the truth. Now, there are increasing numbers before this happened, before the Hamas raid, of people within Israel that were against what the Israeli state was doing to the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
But after the Hamas onslaught and massacre, which, while not acceptable in any state or form, is still not unexpected. When you push people against a wall and you trap them in, at some point there's going to be a reaction. The state of Israel's reaction to what happened to them because of Hamas was disproportionate. The example I can give is they wanted to go after that one captain,
mm-hmm.
and they bombed the entire hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So far, over 8,000 people have been killed. Yes, the hostages should be returned to Israel. Yes, that should not have happened.
And some of them are currently being released as this is yeah. being recorded.
And yes, Hamas is a terrorist organization. I will say it is. And so far, they have been very unwilling to really work with the Israeli states to put an end to this ongoing conflict.
I would just like to jump in and make a note as well. I was going to say this later in the roundtable, but I just want to interject and add this now, too. I think that it's very appropriate to call the existence of Hamas a terrorist organization as a reaction to the conditions that well over a million people have been placed into. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, especially here in the global north, in what we call, you know, quote-unquote Western democracies, mm-hmm. we really have this detachment from how terrorist actions and terrorist organizations begin.
Mm-hmm.
If you take, for example, the situation in Syria or the situation in Iraq or in Afghanistan, we have a group of people who has been either colonized or repeatedly attempted to be colonized by outside nations.
Or erased
entirely in the case of the Palestinians. And what that does is that creates intergenerational trauma and economic situations where people cannot develop generational wealth so that they can support their families, so that they can create their own lives. And it creates the perfect breeding ground for these extremist organizations to step in and say, well, we have the answer and we're going to provide it to you.
But here's where I wanted to go. I don't disagree with you at all.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where I wanted to go. I wanted to go to the point where people are screaming, oh, these people are anti-Semites. People who don't approve of the state of Israel's behavior are anti-Semites. That is a red herring. I am Jewish. I am not anti-Semitic. I am anti-Israel, the state's policy. I am anti the United States sending arms and aid to a country that is already amply armed and dangerous. Yes. Mm-hmm. I am, you know, the United States needs to keep its nose out of things.
Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
I'm kind of aware that my understanding is that a growing number of citizens of Israel or people from Israel are less and less religious. A lot of like in the United States and other mm-hmm. Western countries, and so there's like the government of Israel, and there's the Jewish people of all stripes, and then there's the secular Israelis who are not necessarily religious in any way, mm-hmm. but many of whom are really against how the government is, but they're like three separate things in my mind.
In my mind, religious wars have always been a smokescreen for something else.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, I think that fundamentalism of any stripe is dangerous. But people use religion, governments use religion, factions use religion to whip up fury against, quote, the other.
Yeah, and fear.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important delineation to make from the both of you, is that this is not a conflict of religion. This is a conflict of nationality. This is a conflict...
It's land.
Over land, over resources. This is a conflict mm-hmm. between varying different ethnic groups that have taken on nationalistic pride in the way that they operate. I would say that for a lot of the secular Israelis who still support the Israeli government in its policies and actions, the Palestinians, it's not the religious aspect of Israel that's driving it. It would be more the nationalistic drive, I think. And like you said, Israel does not appreciate information outside of its official narrative that paints the Palestinians.
Some of the more dangerous groups within, I'm not going to say in Israel because they're in the West Bank, are the settler populations.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very militant against the Palestinians. They're on Palestinian land.
It's international law says that they're not supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But it's a lot like Manifest Destiny here in our own country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
Over 100 years ago. If you cloak your economic desires in a robe of either religion or ethnicity,
thank you,
then it makes it easier, you know, mm-hmm. to wipe out an Indian tribe, for instance, a Native American tribe, to get their land, which you believe in your heart God has given you.
Well, that's an interesting point, because last week there was a rally and a protest in front of the courthouse here in Tacoma. And it was organized by Jewish Voice for Peace, Democratic Socialists, and the members of the Federated Tribes.
Interesting.
And Nancy Schippenauer spoke. Oh, she's one of the elders. I believe she is... Salish, I may have the wrong tribe, but she and the other person who spoke from the tribes, were brilliant. And they drew the parallels with the United States taking indigenous lands, slaughtering indigenous people, and then crafting laws that declared the indigenous people as terrorists for trying to protect their own land. And they drew that parallel with what's going on in Palestine. So it's a complicated issue, but I think our guts should be able to tell us and steer us right from wrong. There are ongoing actions in support of Palestinian rights. That doesn't mean that I'm against Israeli rights or Jewish rights. I am not anti-Jewish.
Right.
I am not anti-Semitic. As a matter of fact, when I first came out to the West Coast, I was so innocent. I was in my 20s. And I remember like trying to open a bank account and wondering why the reception I got was so cold.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly it dawned on me that people out here thought I was indigenous.
Right.
Then I got it. Because it reminded me of going down to school in North Carolina with a house mother down there saying, "Why, sugar, I thought you were white,"
mm-hmm.
when I was in the dormitory. No, I'm not white.
What?
Yeah. And so I can empathize about the misery on both sides. And I will never promote violence but we have to have cooler heads. And the IWW historically has not advocated for our members to go march off to war.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's...
quite the opposite, actually.
Yeah. Go ahead, Gordon.
Well, the Wobblies had an expression back in the day when they were arguing against participation in World War One, and one of the slogans was, and I find this to be very effective, a bayonet is a weapon with a worker at both ends.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's good.
That's how they phrased it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't view it as Americans versus Germans. Mm-hmm. National interest. They viewed it as workers being used to fight workers.
So, listener, I'm not advocating political candidates or anything like that, but if you're in the Tacoma area and would like to help us banner on Mondays at noon, and us being Veterans for Peace and Jewish Voice for Peace, you are welcome to come and find us over by the Dome at noon and help us banner. To educate people driving back and forth on the freeway of what the issues are. I wanted to invite people that wanted to find a way to be effective to come help us banner on Monday at noon. We do it every Monday, except this coming Monday, I think, is Veterans Day, and we will not be available. We'll be marching in a parade for peace and non-militarism. But Veterans for Peace and Jewish Voice for Peace meet most Mondays at noon on East D Street by the Dome on the overpass. And we always need more people to help us banner.
And what do the banners say?
Well, they say different things, okay, depending on the occasion. We are currently alerting people to the fact that the U.S. military is exacerbating climate chaos, that Israeli policy toward the Gaza Strip equals treatment during the Warsaw Ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
We change our banners to be topical. Each banner takes at least 4 people. More people equal more banners. Mm-hmm. We do it for 1 hour on Mondays. Come help us.
And I think to close out on the topic of criticizing Israel versus anti-Semitism as a whole.
Yeah.
I watched recently, for my own personal education, there was a great video by a YouTuber I follow called Philosophy Tube. And she was talking about the history of anti-Semitism and what anti-Semitism does in relation to things like white supremacy and so on and so forth. And I would like to make an important note to the listener that when we support Gaza, when we support the Palestinians, of course, we're not supporting Hamas. We've already said, of course, we condemn that organization. But please be aware of who you're organizing with, and please be aware of where you're getting your information from, because it has been a long-standing tactic of white supremacist organizations or individuals to infiltrate these conversations and try to sneak in genuine anti-Semitism in through the back door.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that has happened, especially over the past decade and a half. Philosophy Tube used an example where there was it was some kind of speech or some kind of rally, and it was titled something like Free Speech on Israel. Mm-hmm. And then the first person who gets up on the podium starts denying the Holocaust.
Right.
So please be aware of where you're getting your information from on this particular issue and the people that you're organizing with. Of course, the rallies that we attend and the information that we're getting about this situation, we very clearly vet and are very careful to make sure that we do not include those kinds of individuals or those kinds of motives.
And I have a couple more things I want to say.
Go ahead.
So, yes, anti-Semitism has been on the rise. And there have been people who have been killed or injured recently, whether they happen to be Jewish people in the United States. I think a little boy was killed recently,
mm-hmm,
and his mother stabbed.
Palestinian.
No, that was a Palestinian-American kid.
Okay.
6 years old.
Yeah. Or whether it's a synagogue being bombed. That is an inescapable fact. It's happening. But
terrorism.
It is terrorism. But one of the things that I'm frequently reminded of as a Jew is there is an expression, Tikkun Olam. And one of the obligations we have as Jewish people, Tikkun Olam, is to try to heal the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to seek truth in order to be able to do that work.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So we will try to continue to report on this situation as it continues to unfold. As we have previously stated, there is a larger and larger coalition of labor unions here in the United States and in Europe and in other parts of the world that have called for a ceasefire, that are forming petitions to pressure their governments or their trade unions to call for a ceasefire. The number of trade unions that are joining in that grows by the day. I mean, I've just, especially from a lot of the labor-related sources that I've seen on the internet, it seems to be a growing number of workers who are beginning to form solidarity organizations within their union branches in order to support the stop of any kind of military aid through their union and through their labor to Israel for it to enact its policies against citizens of the Gaza Strip. And of course, we encourage any of our listeners to find these organizations and lend support to them where and when you can. And of course, like you said, there will be a rally in downtown Tacoma every Monday at noon.
No, it's not a rally in Tacoma downtown.
Sorry.
It's a bannering event on the overpass by the dome. Well, we've just about spoken our piece, and I know that this is a union program, and that's what we're here for. Mm-hmm. But there are many other groups that are also working to try to get us to do a ceasefire successfully and to have the U.S. government not be sending more arms over there. And so if you're already in a union that's involved, that's great. If you want to find another organization that is doing the work too, please look into it. There's Veterans for Peace. You don't have to be a veteran. You can be an associate member. There's Democratic Socialists. There's 350 organizations. There are many organizations that realize the folly of this.
Indivisible. And Jewish Voice for Peace.
And Jewish Voice for Peace,
Indivisible.
Too. Indivisible. All. I mean, it's not just unions. Thank God. Because what we've got, no pun intended there, what we've got now is people crossing their own little silos and joining hands with each other. We know that we have to do the work. You know, usually I do a section on environmental unionism and blowing things up and creating more weapons and burning things down when the planet is in chaos anyhow, as far as the climate is just insane.
It's egregious. Yeah,
it's insane. So to go on with environmental news, locally, I'm going to give you the bad news first, and then we're going to go on to some of the good news. Those of you who have been following the mega warehouse push, unfortunately, we lost. The warehouse is going in. Mm. And what will happen is the groups that have been working to try to prevent that will go on and try to get changes in the Washington State SEPA law that will address things like this in the future.
Could you elaborate on that for the listeners?
What is SEPA?
SEPA is, it's the Supplemental Environmental Protection Act. And the trouble is when we tried to go to court on this, because they were in violation of the Environmental Protection Act, we were told that there was nothing in the SEPA that would address health impacts of the residents there. So it was perfectly legal.
It seems a bit counterintuitive.
Right, almost. It does. So we have to work to get the Washington State SEPA law language changed.
So it's by default not there.
Yeah, if it's not there, it's just not possible. So the work is not done, but we've lost this one battle, which is very sad.
And to remind the listener, this proposed huge, huge mega warehouse is over an aquifer, and imagine that environmentally.
Yeah.
Not to mention the increased traffic from all of the trucks and the pavement, which could potentially block the aquifer and also affect runoff and things like
and
that.
And create heat islands and the fact that they'll be chopping down trees when we need more trees.
Right.
Where so, do the birds and squirrels go?
That's a loss. But I do want to let people know that on November 16th, there is a virtual summit on the environment. And also, there is an organization, a company called Kingspan Corporation in California that they should be following. They make, quote, green building supplies. And the people there are organizing because of violations of air pollution and because they're being exposed to chemical toxins. So the company is Kingspan, K-I-N-G-S-P-A-N. Kingspan Corporation, And they can go on the Environmental Unionism site on Facebook and follow that there.
And the Environmental Unionism site is connected to the IWW.
Correct? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH.
Then there is a campaign against climate change. A meeting is ahead of the COP28 that's going to be happening this winter. That is the one I was telling you about, the virtual summit, November 16th. You can go to London and attend, or you can go online and attend. And once again, if you go onto Facebook to the IWW Environmental Unionism Caucus, you can find ways to get connected with that.
Sounds good.
So there you go. I did not mention when I was giving the environmental report about the mega warehouse that there is another development in addition to trying to change the SEPA law that the listener might want to get involved in. And that is the PSE, Puget Sound Energy, which is not Puget Sound, it's Australia and it's Canada, and it's a for-profit company. They built the 8 million gallon pressurized liquefied natural gas storage and refinery in the Tacoma Tide Flats that nobody wanted. Well, that none of us normal people wanted.
Yeah.
That the Tacoma residents would only at peak use be using 7% of it. And now they plan to export most of it, and they want to stick the ratepayers with 43% of the cost of building it. And you can let Puget Sound Energy and Tacoma Public Utilities know what you think of that idea, and also our state regulatory agency, because it's not a done deal yet.
Thank you for telling us about that. That's pretty big.
Yeah, because I'm a PSE customer myself, and I live nowhere near Tacoma. I live in Bremerton.
But you'd be paying for it.
I'd be paying for the bomb in your front yard.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you for paying for the bomb in my front yard.
Anytime.
Tell a little about it for the listener who doesn't know.
Well, this goes back to about 2017 when we had just finished, we being the citizens of Tacoma, in pushing back the idea of a gigantic methanol refinery in the downtown Tacoma area. We won that battle. We won it probably because they let us win it, because all the time they were working on this project, which is Puget Sound Energy's 8 million gallon compressed liquefied natural gas, which is it's frac gas.
So LNG.
LNG that they wanted to put in our tide flats. And they have already run pipes by schools, by daycares. And if you get gas, the pipes are right directly in your home, and we have been able to delay it. It is not in use yet, but it's a horrible thing. And now they want to bill us for the cost of building this bomb. Mm-hmm. And I call it a bomb because it is highly ignitable. It is, how can I put this? It burns at 5,000 degrees. There is no way that a little fence around the property is going to keep the gas explosion from traveling up and down the pipes. And we've seen that in Philadelphia and in other places where homes suddenly explode. Mm-hmm. It's flammable with water, and it's built on the tide flats. It's in a Lahar zone. Don't get me started. Anyhow, at least let's not pay for that abomination.
Absolutely.
Stick it to PSE.
So they're involved everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know that they were an international.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's clever, Puget Sound Energy.
It sounds so nice. So
sounds
local.
All Puget Soundy, doesn't it?
Yeah, sure does. Greetings, fellow workers. My name's fellow worker Gordon. I come from that wonderful land across the Narrows Bridge, Bremerton and Kitsap County and environs. I'm a member of the Tacoma, proud member of the Tacoma branch of the IWW. And I've been doing some book reviews of late. The last book review that I did and the one before that was the Beyond the Rebel Girl, which discussed women in our union, besides Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, a lot of unknown women who were pivotal members. And also I reviewed last time a book, Under the Iron Heel, which took its title from the work of Jack London, who wrote a dystopian novel back in the 19-teens. And this book I'm going to be reviewing today is called Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Era Philadelphia. And it was written by Peter Cole. He's a professor of history at Western Illinois University. And the book is published in 2007 by University of Illinois Press. And it's an excellent read. And the reason it's interesting is because this is the third book that I'm reviewing that I've read of late that focuses pretty much on the same period of history and also on the IWW. And the same period of history was viewed through three different lenses. The first one was of feminism. The other one, Under the Iron Hill, was more of a historical presentation of the IWW as a whole. And this one is about the IWW's Local 8, as they called it, of the Marine Transport Workers Union in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And pretty much the same time frame. So it actually opens up, you know, with some historical information. First of all, the professor defines, he uses the word stevedore throughout the book. Okay, and I had always thought that a stevedore was a longshoreman. But the difference is that he's referring to stevedore as the companies that hired longshoremen to load and unload ships back in the day. The union, some of the unions still exist, but unfortunately Local 8 folded. And he focuses on he focuses in on a 9-year period, and I thought it was way longer. Being a Wobbly for a long time, I've heard of the legendary union organizer Ben Fletcher. We always hold him up, and rightfully so, as an exemplar of African American labor unionists who lined up with the IWW. And he was there, unfortunately, during the time of his residency and activism in Philadelphia. He was convicted on a trumped-up charge of sedition, sent to prison for a couple of years, and pretty much pulled the rug out from under him. The state pulled the rug out from under him as far as being an effective organizer. But we rightfully sing his praises because Local 8 represented the first ever voluntary cooperation in the North between African-American and other workers, white workers principally. However, with the caveat that a lot of the white workers in Philadelphia were from ethnic minorities. One of the famous tactics of the day, especially in the coal mining industry, was to actually recruit strikebreakers and miners in Europe who were desperate for work, bring them to the United States with all kinds of promises, and use them as scabs and strikebreakers, most of the time without their knowledge. People find themselves, you know, some of them were lifelong syndicalists, which is a fancy name for unionists in Europe, find themselves breaking a strike, and they couldn't bring themselves to do it a lot of times. The book itself is written as a scholarly treatment. I mean, it's a history book, so you'll find plenty of end notes, footnotes, a bibliography, all that kind of neat, serious student of history stuff. But it's written in a very accessible language. The author gives realistic info regarding the contradictions, not only between employers and workers, but employers amongst themselves, because after all, they're in competition. So they would use various tactics to undermine each other until they finally found a voice as a syndicate, if you will, under an alliance flag, like an industry type thing, like the Washington Builders Association or something like that. In other words, it's an owner's industry. All right, so he brings that aspect into account because it damn near sunk them. The IWW won recognition on the Philadelphia waterfront, only on the Philadelphia waterfront, to the extent that they ran the waterfront. They ran the job. In the old days, the author points out that to hire on the docks was a miserable process. They had a thing called the shape-up until very recently, until like the 1930s and 40s. It was called the shape-up. Basically, it's a slave market. If you wanted to work that day, you showed up, no matter what weather, at 7 a.m. down on the waterfront, and you were recruited, you know, to do a certain job, unload or load a certain ship. Okay, and so that was kind of a brutal way to get hired. In other words, you didn't have a job till you showed up, and that was every day.
And you might not get picked.
And you might not get picked. Sometimes if you got blacklisted for being a troublemaker or a unionist, you'd never get picked.
And there's no guarantee that you'd have that job tomorrow.
Exactly right. And as a matter of fact, if they didn't like your face or didn't like the way you parted your hair, you were out. So that's a pretty brutal system. He did a good historical sketch of Philadelphia in general, which has been a major U.S. port, not these days, but back in the day, it was a major United States port, busier than New York, right? As busy as San Francisco, okay? And so they're very important. And they're like 80 nautical miles inland. Actually, they're a riverside port. But back east, the estuaries are pretty big, you know, and they empty into the Atlantic Ocean. But this was a highly regarded port. Philadelphia was also a manufacturing center. And one of their slogans was, we make everything from button hooks to battleships. And it was true. They had a big shipbuilding industry. They had a naval shipyard in Philadelphia that was huge, and it closed up in the 1970s. And they called themselves the workshop to the world. So when the Irish people came over in the 1840s and 50s because of the famine, immediately there was some racial tension between the waterfront workers in Philadelphia, who were mostly African American, right, and the Irish people who came in. And, you know, employers love this. Employers love to foment disunity amongst racial groups, ethnic groups, religious groups. They'll do it every time. And that just benefits the employers. So another big industry in Philadelphia was garment and textiles. And it was just a generally, you know, a dynamo of productivity. But longshore work was very precarious. So as well as these shape-ups, sometimes they would have shifts. They would have to get everything, for instance, offloaded from a ship within 36 hours or so. If they didn't, you know, things could spoil. They would miss the tide. Mm-hmm. So it was very rigid. You know, so you could end up working for up to 36 to, you know, sometimes 2 days straight without a break. And if you took a break, or if you were just plain tired out, they said, well, you don't have to show up tomorrow. But what a lot of people don't realize about longshore work is that there was a hierarchy of skills. There were guys who specialized in loading and unloading deep sea vessels. In other words, international trade. And they were usually considered the more experienced or the more skilled. And then there was guys they called coastwise longshoremen, which meant the smaller ships that transported goods to and from Philadelphia, pretty much along the coast or down to the Gulf. Okay, so they had a hierarchy, and plus, who worked in the hatch, who worked on the pier, who worked on the deck. These were all sort of artificial differentiations so they could pay different wages to different skill levels. And we're not talking big wages back then. We're talking, you know, 45 cents an hour and stuff like that. So we talked about how important Philadelphia was. And when the Irish came in, they basically ran the waterfront for about 50 years. From 1850 till about 1900. And then, because of the Civil War, there was one of the great migrations of black people, African-American people, from the Deep South. And you'll remember Reconstruction in the early 1870s. You know, but a lot of the black people said, no, we're getting out of here. and they moved north. And so that created a lot of friction between the people who were already in power on the waterfront, which was at that point, the Irish guys, and these black people, black men, who newly came to town and needed work. So the employers exacerbated that, but the workers began to work that out for themselves. And so the work environment at the time is horrendous. And I say this because I worked 31 years on a waterfront in Bremerton. It's not the same thing, of course, and I had the benefit of machinery and OSHA protection, and wore a hard hat and steel-toed shoes.
And a lot of those protections were because of labor actions.
That's true. But they were also the rules, which made it good. You know, a pain in the neck sometimes, but it protected us. And back then, there was nothing of the kind. and a lot of men got injured. And I say men because there were absolutely no women in the longshore industry at that time. There are now. Well, the industry has also changed. But picture, you know, cranes, derricks, slinging loads that were not secured aboard and off ship. The trucks that had to move the goods from the ship or the pier to a warehouse or to a mercantile. There were horse-drawn carriages. So you had horse-drawn carriages and teamsters when they were actually teamsters, meaning running a team of horses or mules, and they're all over the pier, and so there's, you know, confusion. My point is, a lot of people got injured. And if you got injured back then, lost an arm, a hand, a finger, tough luck. You know, you were just, either if you couldn't do the work, you weren't hired. So what happens is that, and being a waterfront worker myself, some guys you want to work with because you got kind of a mental telepathy going where you know each other's movements. And so these pairings formed up, and these, what they called gangs, and they still call them gangs today, meaning working groups, you know, groups of working people. So imagine that scenario, and then it just so happens that your work partner that day happens to be a black man, and you're a white guy, and yet your life is depending on him, and his life is depending on you. So there was a natural solidarity that formed up, and, you know, where all the craziness about, well, he's a black person, I can't associate with him, that stuff goes out the window, as any soldier or any military person who's been in a combat situation could probably tell you. That's the last thing on anybody's mind, is if, can you trust this guy to keep your back? Well, that's what happened. And so the author concentrates on the period between 1913 and roughly 1924. So during that time, remember, World War I was going on, and that greatly increased the power of the government. They put in all kinds of rules to win the war. Increased government power. There was a great migration going on. The Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917 had occurred. There was a Red Scare going on right after World War I in 1919, throwing thousands of wobblies and other unionists and other radical political people in prison. And there was a flu epidemic in 1919, mm-hmm. which we, you know, we've revisited. So what I'm getting at is that the wobblies ran the waterfront there and basically provided stable working conditions and good wages for only about 9 years. Then the state and the employers got together, militated against the IWW, and eventually broke the union. And the author points out is that some of the black men who came up from the South were leery of unions in the first place, didn't want to support the unions, and they were actively recruited to, you know, go against the IWW. Also, another union got in the act. That was the International Longshore Association, and they were an AFL union. And they got in the act, and they started to compete with the Wobblies for membership. So this is, like in the other two books, it predicts the downfall of the IWW. But I'm maintaining that our influence to this day goes way beyond our membership, and that this book offers a really good insight into labor politics and conditions of the day. And extrapolate from that, and you can see a lot of parallels to these days. So labor solidarity always wins out, except if you have people actively, you know, undermining you.
But you know what? We're still here.
Yes, we are. and we've defeated all these predictions that we've disappeared. Now, historically speaking, yeah, we took a big blow in the 1920s, the IWW did. But we're still around. And we're still working for the liberation of the working class.
And we're organizing, you know, more and more workplaces nowadays than we have in the past several decades, ever since we've tried to rebuild the unions since mm-hmm. that time.
As are other unions also.
Mm-hmm.
Unions
absolutely.
Are thriving.
What's the Mark Twain quote? Rumors of my demise were premature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a fascinating take. I mean, I've always wanted to learn more about, you know, the Local 8 of the IWW there mm-hmm. in Philadelphia. I know that that's something that, within union circles, we kind of mythologize.
It is.
It's this very cookie-cutter story of, you know, black right. workers and white workers in the early 1900s realized their solidarity and started working together.
No.
And then there's this whole rich historical text that's just kind of, you know, buried underneath that mythology of a very simplistic story. And I think that this book in particular.
So what's the name of the book again?
It's called Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Era Philadelphia. And it is a fascinating book, and it is highly readable, even if you're not a history professor. So you can get the book just by looking it up. And I got it through the IWW store.
Thank you, fellow worker Gordon.
Thank you so much. Coming to the closing of our episode today, we have a couple of brief announcements about local events going on. I think the first one we might want to jump on is that in Centralia, on November 11th, we have our annual remembrance of Wesley Everest and the other IWWs who were persecuted, and in the case of Everest, killed as a result of the Centralia tragedy. We go down there every year on the 11th of November in order to commemorate the IWWs that are buried down there and that were persecuted as a result of trying to form unions and the timber workers at the time.
I have an announcement that after over 100 years, yes, the IWW has been granted permission to install a monument to the fallen IWWs right near the monument to the fallen American Legionnaires who started the riot in the first place.
But so this is going to be a very special gathering,
yeah,
and a dedication.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to happen at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on the 11th. And yes, we know it's Veterans Day, but we don't give a damn. We celebrate our union's history on that day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And so where is the plaque going to be placed?
It's
going to
be in that main park.
Washington Park.
Washington,
really?
Park, oh, yeah.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Interesting side note to that, Washington Park is not named for the state, but it's named for the founder of Centralia, interestingly enough, an African-American
That's
man.
Right. That's George right.
George Washington.
Yes, I've recently learned about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, he founded the town, and so they put they named the park after him. And yeah. There's a statue of him there, too.
Yeah. So this is going to be a pretty big November 11th gathering, as we've previously mentioned, because we are finally getting the permission from the city to tell our half of the story in our own monument, to talk about the IWW's perspective about that tragedy, and also to provide a greater historical education for the public as well.
Well, and to give a little context here, Gordon said we don't give a damn about Veterans Day. Mm-hmm. Well, this happened on Veterans Day, of
Armistice
course.
Day.
Yeah,
Armistice
the first day. The first Armistice
yeah,
Day.
Armistice Day. And the bosses down in Centralia basically used the Legionnaires that were coming back
mm-hmm.
to harass and womp and riot and attack the IWW office. So actually, it's no coincidence that this is happening on Veterans Day.
And the irony of that being that Wesley Everest, who was killed as a result of the tragedy.
Lynched
as a result of the tragedy, was a veteran himself.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm a veteran too, so you know, I care about myself. But what I was saying is that we're not celebrating Veterans Day per se. We're celebrating our own union's history and the history of the working class.
Absolutely.
That sounds better than the comment a few minutes ago.
There is going to be a Free Palestine Veterans Day rally on Saturday, November the 11th at noon, if any of us are looking to do any activism locally on the 11th. This is an event hosted by the Tacoma Democratic Socialists of America. It's at Tollefson Plaza. They are going to be gathering in solidarity with the civilians of the Gaza Strip who are currently under bombardment and are being pushed out of their homes in the northern half of the Strip.
And being killed.
And being killed by airstrikes as well.
And starved.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that the listener ought to realize is that for the state of Israel to tell the Palestinians to leave Gaza for their own safety, they will not be allowed back into Gaza.
No.
And it's hypocrisy of the first order because they won't let them in or out.
Mm-hmm.
They can't leave even by the beach.
Right.
That's right. But they've banished them anyway.
And those are a couple of the local events that we invite our listeners to attend, both the rally for the citizens of Gaza in downtown Tacoma, as well as the Centralia rally on the 11th in Centralia for the fallen fellow workers of the Centralia tragedy. And we thank you again for your listenership, whether you're listening from 101.9 Radio Tacoma, 95.3 KTQA, or 94.9 KZAX up in Bellingham. We're really thankful that you're supporting union-produced and labor-focused radio. We certainly look forward to seeing you at next month's episode, and solidarity.
Solidarity forever.
Solidarity.